You are now listening to the IELTS podcast. Learn from tutors and ex-examiners who are masters of IELTS preparation. Your host, Ben Worthington.
Hi there, podcast listeners. Today I've got Eric Roth, and he's the author of quite a few actually, English books, English textbooks, and he's going to help us today and give us some world-class advice about speaking in general and how to get the best out of your own ability. He's been teaching like non-native English speakers how to get through tests, how to pass exams. He's got how many years experience have you got in this, Eric?
Well, all told, I've got over 20 years experience.
Wow.
Thank you for that very kind introduction.
You're welcome.
I think it's really key to focus on the authentic context. And so, like on one of the tests, when I was the director of the Adult Education Center in West Hollywood, we had a lot of immigrants and refugees from the former Soviet Union who were under pressure to become U.S. citizens or they would lose their benefits.
Wow.
And so getting them through that citizenship test was really important. And it's an authentic third party test. And so it's got, you know, high stakes. And yeah. I think the IELTS test is also a high stakes test.
Yes.
So it deserves a lot of focus, a lot of attention, and it's worth investing time and energy in trying to deconstruct the inner logic of the test.
I see. And how did you go about that? Just by like analyzing the test?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're fortunate in that, in the interest of fairness, the federal government agreed that the four-page document would ask all of the questions exactly in order. Now, this was extremely significant because it meant that you knew what the questions were going to be. Right. So if you had very limited English skills, we could still train you to memorize appropriate answers using appropriate phrases if you just kept track of what question it was.
I see.
I'm not saying that's the best way to get through it. It's obviously best if you are completely comfortable in the language and you can answer each question with the in the right verb tense with the appropriate vocabulary and demonstrate your considerable intelligence with detailed responses.
Yeah.
But if for the weak students,
so you developed like a strategy to get them through this test based because you knew the order of the questions and what was going to happen. So you gave them like a good drilling.
Absolutely.
And how would you prepare students who would have to take the IELTS exam, which is like part one, a bit of an interview, part two, where they have to give a presentation on a few points, and it could be any topic, and
right.
then part three, where it's like questions related to mini presentation or discussion they gave. How would you prepare them for that?
Well, part one, you know, the questions are all related to you
exactly.
and your life. And I would focus on three tips. One, be prepared with a range of stories and as soon as possible, demonstrate comfort with a present perfect verb tense. So, you know, I have been studying for the IELTS for 6 months. I have decided to focus on electrical engineering
my
studies.
Uh-huh. To get the exam off to a good start.
Yeah, as soon as you demonstrate that you have control of the verb tense, then it's kind of checked off.
Yeah.
So, done. You know how to use present perfect. You have control of verb tenses, and you can talk about yourself. So how long have you had this job? I've had this job for 9 months. I have worked in this industry since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can anchor it with and practice those questions in advance. And you don't know the exact question, but you know that for part one, they are going to relate to you and your life. It's a conversation. It's a casual conversation, but it's also a highly structured conversation with a very particular goal. Yeah. And you don't want to be stressed because it's a test. You want to think of it as a conversation, but it's an important, meaningful conversation. And you want to make sure that you demonstrate adequate, sufficient language proficiency as soon as possible.
So straight away, start showing the examiner what you can do. And that way you're going to get confident yourself. If you start off on a good footing, you know, and you're demonstrating, it's going to put you at ease for later parts of the test.
Absolutely. And this is, you're talking about your life.
Yeah.
So you know, you are the world's leading expert on your life. So you don't have to worry and be anxious about, well, I may do this, I may that. It's your life, your story. Just keep in mind two things. One, verb tense. And two, if you can have some nice terms that give us some linking language will be helpful. And this will be helpful later too. In parts two and three.
Could you give us some examples by what you mean by that? Some linking terms.
Well, if you tell me when you have an opinion, you should have a reason. If you have made a decision, you should show us the consequences or the rationale. So use words like because, so. Likewise, when you're going through, I would say things like, in fact, for example, afterwards, you're giving us kind of a sense of narrative so we can follow the story. And it's easy for some people, especially if you're worried about your English, to just give us information and forget the important connecting words. So you've got the experience in your mind, and now you need to help us see that experience and understand that. Using those connecting phrases will help us do that.
And
every time you have an opinion, you should have a reason. Every time you make a decision, you should have a rationale. And there should be some we should understand the consequences. And of course, this is an advertisement for yourself. This is an attempt to tell your story from a positive perspective. Let me give an example related to IELTS. At the university, I work at University of Southern California, and we do the international student exam.
Right.
And many times in the beginning, I almost want to tell students you're being too honest. You're arguing against yourself.
I see.
They'll say things like, I'll say, why did you choose the University of Southern California? And they'll say, well, it was the only one that took me. I'm not a good student. I don't know why they took me. Why would you say that? We don't tell the university they made a mistake. Certainly don't tell us that your English is too weak.
Yeah.
Let us make that decision if you need a remedial class.
Yeah.
But don't tell us to put you in a class. You know, don't argue against your own case. I don't get it.
Exactly. One teacher told me about a student who started the speaking exam. My name is Lee, and my English is really bad, and this is an English exam.
But for the student point of view, you owe it to yourself to do as well as you can.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is studying and knowing what to expect. So in part one, you know, we're going to ask you about your life and your experiences. And I think having a lot of questions and practice responses to predictable questions will help on that. Two, keep in mind, you do want to pay some attention to verb tense.
Yes.
Many students get confused, and that's an early sign that an examiner will note. So if you're initially pegged as needy as having verb tense problems, your score is going to be lower. And that first 45 seconds, 1 minute, it's partly to put you at ease and relax, but also there's some initial assessment of the student's skill. If you can establish that you have control of, you know, present perfect, you're in good shape.
Yeah, I see. And you said as well before that the student needs to, well, you said some students, they present it like a block of information.
Yeah, and it looks like it's memorized, because it often is.
How can a student avoid that?
Yeah, no, that's not good. We want to have a real conversation.
Yeah.
And so you want to keep in mind tempo. You don't want to just shoot your answer at us like a machine gun. Especially when it's followed by a question and then the student doesn't understand the question.
I see.
So you want to avoid the excessive memorization and just be comfortable at a natural tempo in responding.
Get used to these type of questions, but also get used to slightly varying them. Get used to the speed of the answer. And also pay a lot of attention to the questions as well that you're going to
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So often, and you see this with native speakers too, in other authentic contexts, where people will answer the question they wanted to be asked or expected to be asked rather than the question you did ask. It's very common in job interviews for applicants to respond to the question they wanted to be asked rather than the question they were asked.
In an exam contest, it shows that you haven't listened or you misunderstood, which shows a lack of listening ability. In fact, one teacher said that the speaking exam is a listening exam in that you have to pay so much attention to the questions, and that the writing exam is a reading exam for exactly the same reasons, that you have to pay real attention to the question being asked in front, you know, when you're doing the writing part.
That's an excellent point, Ben. And one way I summarize that for students is they need to listen louder.
Listen louder. I like that. By that you mean just turn up the volume when they're listening.
Pay great attention to the question that was asked.
I see.
You know, really focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's not an easy task either, especially in the exam, because with all the nerves and stuff. So, yeah, that would need to be practiced with a partner, I imagine.
Yeah, I say practice may not make perfect, but practice makes progress. And so practice likely questions over and over and over again and in different variants. Now, the IELTS is a much better exam than many others. And one reason why it's such a strong exam is that there is relatively limited range of what questions will be asked in each of the three parts. So that nothing's going to be coming out of completely what we call left field. There'll be no crazy questions. And that's helpful.
Yeah.
That's very helpful.
Definitely. When I was doing my research, I read something about reflective questions. Now, are there any techniques for these types of questions?
Well, I think it's helpful to look at your response, look at your life, and think about how did you feel about, you know, what's your favorite food? And you can always, part of that reflective thing, we ask this very abstract question. Well, I don't know, maybe ice cream now. Well, it's helpful maybe to put it back in context as a child of 8, as a 15-year-old, as a 22-year-old, and now. So just by adding that little condition of thinking about yourself at different ages as someone who's developing and evolving and growing, then rather than thinking of yourself as a static person.
Yeah.
I think it's very helpful, especially because many of us have faced setbacks and we haven't always done as well as we hoped. Mm-hmm. And we need to be resilient. And we need to recognize that we fell down in one context, in one situation, at one time. And then how did we recover? How did we do better? If we can just constantly think about in some context, then I think our answers will be more honest, be more detailed, and more illuminating. So that's what I mean by being reflective. And then recognizing how you might have changed from an 8-year-old to a 15-year-old to a 22-year-old to, you know, who you are now.
I see. Putting it in the context of almost like transformation.
Yes, I think that's helpful. So if we're asked a question like, you know, what role has technology had on your life? Well, that's such an abstract, big question. I don't know how to answer it. But if I can take it, if I can put it in some context, well, as an 8-year-old, I did this. And as a 15-year-old, I did this. And as a 22-year-old, I learned how to program. You know, if you can just give us particular activities for each of those ages, then you're giving us a narrative. And that narrative should be one of progress, by the way. Yeah. It's a positive narrative you're telling us because you're giving us an advertisement for yourself.
Exactly, yeah. I was just thinking the same. And the examiner doesn't have to work as hard. You know, and they can just sort of like sit back and think, right, this guy is confident. He can communicate, or she can communicate, whoever. And yeah, you've made the examiner's life easier, and you've shown a tremendous ability because you've used the past. Well, when I was 7 years old, I did this. I liked this. Now, when I was 15, I preferred this to that.
Oh, beautiful.
You know, and you show the examiner the whole range. But I like this framework a lot because you could use it for countries. You know, when I was in China, I preferred this. Now I prefer this. And you can it's very flexible. If you're switched on, you can use it and you can deepen and lengthen practically any question. It just takes a little bit of skill with it, you know, a little bit of practice with it.
Absolutely. And it lends itself to compare and contrast,
mm-hmm.
which is a useful skill. And you'll be telling more interesting stories.
Exactly. Yeah.
Likewise, if you can layer in, if you don't want to talk about yourself, you can use years to give the answer, you know, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, when I was young, now that I'm older.
Yeah.
You can do it for time, you can do it for place, you can do it for professions, you can do it for any kind of context. But compare and contrast is useful. It's a way to demonstrate storytelling and control of verb tense.
Yeah, that's awesome. And plus, if the student's got a framework to follow and they know, like, okay, for part three, I'm just going to try and tell a tiny little story. I'm going to give a bit of an insight. When I was younger, when I was older, when I was in Russia, when I was in Australia. And having this knowledge and knowing to do this will make the student or make you more relaxed, and there's more probability that your true language ability is going to come out rather than your language ability on test day. That's excellent.
Yes. I think that's really important because we know so many students hurt themselves by allowing the test to become a stressful instead of satisfying experience. I think sometimes get more nervous than they need to about the second part where they think of it as a presentation.
Yeah.
It's called a presentation, but it's really not a presentation. You're just telling us a story.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And just tell us a story in part two.
Yeah, definitely. Just work through it, share it, open up and just tell the story.
And again, give us those connectors. Give us those links.
Uh-huh. And could I just ask you another question?
Sure.
While we're on the topic of like relaxing, do you know any techniques, or how do you advise your students to sort of like slow down and really make it their opportunity to reflect their ability rather than it transforming into a big, chaotic, nervous, stressful event?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a very real question. If you notice, many political leaders, when they are being interviewed on TV, at least in America, or testifying, they will have some water with them because their throat may get dry. So, you know, I think it's okay to have, you know, to do that.
Yeah.
I do silly things like stretch beforehand, maybe go to a private place and just physically stretch and try to stand tall and look confident. And look, I'm bringing out my confident face. It doesn't mean I feel confident, but I'm going to at least look confident.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to, there's a nice expression, fake it till you make it. And I think that there is some of that. Our Catholic friends talk about act as if you have faith. And I think that's a beautiful expression. So go into it knowing that you will do your best. Mm-hmm. And then do your best. So for me, I need to stretch. I need to physically kind of stand tall, make sure I'm looking at the questioners. I feel more comfortable talking a little bit with my hands, not too much, to emphasize appropriate points. And, it, you know, it, sometimes you can shake hands and then, you know, give a real handshake, like you're glad to be there. Not like you're terrified and like, you know, you're just barely alive.
Bring your
life force into the interview.
Exactly. And on a side note, anybody who's listening, when you give a handshake, you've got to squeeze their hand. Too many people, especially, well, around the world, but in England, a handshake has to be, I think in the US as well, but it has to be strong. When somebody gives me a weak hand and it's just floating there and it feels like a piece of wet lettuce, it just makes me cringe. It's horrible.
Yeah, it really is horrible. And it's one of those little things that shouldn't matter because it's a speaking test.
Yeah.
But your physical presence always matters.
Definitely.
And the handshake matters. The eye contact matters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more traditional than some people. And so I'm going to dress in a casual, but casual, comfortable, but not sloppy manner. I'm going to have on a nice shirt.
Exactly.
The shirt should not be wrinkled.
Yes.
You should be there, and you should be glad to be there, and it's a serious, important occasion, and your dress, your manner, your presence should indicate that.
Exactly. Great advice.
Well, this has been a great conversation, Ben.
Yeah, definitely, Eric. Thank you for agreeing to do it.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to IELTSpodcast.com. And remember to leave your email for updates and early access to new podcasts.